translation, this is again Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 18, text number 12. For one who has not renounced the threefold fruits of action, desirable, undesirable, and mixed, accrue after death. But those who are in the renounced order of life have no such result to suffer or enjoy. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. A person in Krishna consciousness, acting in knowledge of his relationship with Krishna, is always liberated. Therefore, he does not have to enjoy or suffer the results of his acts after death. And you would think that because the purport here is only two sentences long, it's not really a very important verse. And it's true. This verse is not really one of the most lectured upon verses of the Bhagavad Gita. But in fact, it is very important. At least for one reason, which is that every one of us has things that we want. And every one of us has things that we don't want. And with most of us, it's mixed. So this verse is certainly relevant to everyone. And it's a kind of a definition. Krishna says here, Trivetam Karmanaha Phalam, the threefold fruits of action are these three things. Now, it's from Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that Srila Prabhupada gives the synonyms that he, in the word for word here, Ishtam, or Anishtam rather, means something which is not desired. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says this means going to hell. No one likes to go to hell. Ishtam means that which is desired, or going to Svargaloka, going to heaven. And Mishram, what's that? Mishram means mixed. So where are we going if our desires are mixed? We're staying here. So you can generally divide these three into the mode of ignorance, the mode of goodness, and the mode of passion, respectively. We know that from elsewhere in chapter 15 of the Bhagavad Gita. Anybody know the verse I'm thinking of? Urdham gacchati sattvastha. Those who are situated in the mode of goodness, they go up. Urdham. Those who are in the mode of passion, they stay put. Their movement is only horizontal. And those who are in the mode of ignorance, they go down, just like the animals. So these are three things that Krishna has actually, if you think about it, he's really dilated on these at great length throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Beginning in chapter 14, it doesn't really begin there, but certainly in chapter 14 he elaborates on the importance of the three modes of material nature. And again in chapter 17 he does so at great length. Even here in chapter 18 we'll see in a few verses, Krishna is continuing to discuss this topic of the three modes of material nature and the impact that they have on the ways that we think, on the ways that we feel, on the ways that we act. So here in chapter 18 we'll see that he discusses different modes of sacrifice in this way. He discusses different modes of charity, different modes of austerity, different kinds of intelligence, different kinds of workers, different kinds of activities. It's really quite fascinating if this information is relevant to you, which means yatanto yoginashchainam pashyantyatman yavastitam. Those who are endeavoring for self-realization, they find this information very fascinating because it's quite relevant to their endeavor. And those who are not endeavoring in this way, Krishna says, they can't see it, even if they try. Therefore, we find way back in chapter 2, in the amazing verse, Krishna has already described that some look upon the soul as amazing, some describe him as amazing, etc., etc., and some, even after hearing from him, they can't understand at all. So we have to be careful not to fall into that category, because that's the default in this material world. All you have to do is nothing, and you will be placed into these lower modes of material nature, especially because this is the nature of the present age, the Kali Yuga. You will be placed by default into the mode of ignorance, eventually, but via the mode of passion. Why via mode of passion? Anybody know? How is it the mode of passion is taking you into ignorance? What's the result of the mode of passion? In a few verses Krishna describes, it seems like nectar in the beginning, but pariname, lo and behold, it's transformed into something that's terribly unpalatable. Whereas the mode of ignorance is something that's unpalatable from beginning to end. So, if you think about it, the ultimate goal of the mode of passion is the mode of ignorance. So beware. All things that seem very appealing in the short term, things that are very attractive to the mind and to the senses of the conditioned soul, they will ultimately cause us to suffer. And that's what's being discussed today. Anishtam means when you go to hell, because at least now, I mean, to be relevant, we're all human beings. Every one of us is inhabiting a human body. And in the human body, all you really have to do is be born and continue to exist. And unless you act in certain ways, and unless you think in certain ways, and unless you elevate yourself, really, while the opportunity lasts, then you are going to go to hell. Because, again, this is Kali Yuga, and the default is that you will be carried downstream, and you are going to commit some activity which is prohibited. Or you're going to fail to perform an activity that is actually enjoined upon you to perform. We don't even know this, generally. In the modern civilization, no one is even informed of the fact that along with a human birth, with a particular swabhava, or a particular set of characteristics, a particular mode of inclination, if you will, along with that human birth comes a particular set of corresponding duties that you have to perform. Especially if you're in the mode of sattva-guna, that's considered to be the Brahman. He has the most responsibility of everyone in the society, because he's responsible for awakening everyone else. When we're in a house that's burning, when I was in America, I was in a shopping mall and there was a song that they were singing, and it said, "How can we sleep while our beds are burning?" So this is the material world. The intelligent class, the insightful class, the virtuous class, the responsible class, has the obligation to awaken those who are less fortunate, those who are less blessed with awareness. Really, awareness is the key word here, because what's the primary symptom of sattva-guna? Awareness. Prakashayati. Just as the sun lights up this universe, so awareness actually illumines all the nine gates of this body. What are the nine gates? Two eyes, two ears, two nostrils, mouth, genital, rectum. Nine gates. When all of those are enlightened by awareness of what to do and what not to do, and when we are aware of their functions, today I was reading that one verse in Padyavali, and it was talking about prana. Actually, here in the 18th chapter also, some of the commentaries discuss the importance of prana. Prana means the 10 kinds of airs that are circulating throughout our body. We're not aware of what they are, but that doesn't mean that they're not working. And a person who's aware of their functions is a person who can actually take advantage to elevate himself by dint of that knowledge. So anyway, awareness is the characteristic of sattva-guna. And the Brahman is the person who has the most of it. He's just blessed in that way. Everybody has their karma. Ishtam, anishtam, or mishram. So when one acts in sattva-guna like this, when one performs what we call niyatam karma. Niyatam karma means the set of obligatory duties that you have to perform according to your conditional nature. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find a very nice verse that explains this. It not explains this, but it hints in this direction when it says, Paraswabhava karmani na prashamsen na garhayat. The Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas, commenting on Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, and in their own independent works as well, Smriti works, they actually quote this verse quite a lot. I've not heard Srila Prabhupada quote it that much. I don't know why he doesn't quote it very much. But the meaning is that one should neither praise nor criticize the conditional nature and the activities that follow from that conditional nature of any other person in this world. And generally, especially when we're in the mode of passion, that's all we can see. We see a different kind of person according to the different conditional nature that that spirit soul has acquired. And we discriminate on the basis of that different covering. And we find it attractive or we find it repulsive, depending on our own conditioning. This is passion. So niyatam karma means along with everyone's own conditioning comes a set of corresponding duties that must be performed, and those are called niyatam, obligatory, regular duties. Niyatam means forever, perpetual, constant, regular, daily, all the time, etc. So one should neither praise that nor criticize that in another person, because if you praise it, the other person becomes encouraged in his mundane activity. And if you criticize it, then the other person becomes discouraged and thinks he or she doesn't have a place. The ultimate purport here is Vishvam ekatmakam pashyam prakritya purushena cha. One should instead see this entire cosmic manifestation operating as a harmonious interplay of purusha and prakriti, matter and spirit. And therefore, every conditional nature has its place in this creation. And all the activities following from that swabhava, they also have their place in this creation. No one is excluded. Everyone is valuable. That's why they exist. Every one of us has a unique flavor of sentiment, of intelligence, of desire, of activity, a motive operation, so to speak, which only we can uniquely offer to the Supreme Lord, and he likes that. What is that from the Taittiriya Upanishad? Raso Vaisa. He himself is rasa, and he's also Rasik Shekhara. He's also the supreme enjoyer of rasa. And everybody's rasa is very much appreciable to the Supreme Lord. So we have to be very careful not to criticize. And perhaps more relevant to our own personal interests is that we have to understand what is our own conditional nature and what is our own duty that follows from it. In Indian history, India never developed an independent field of study called psychology. India also never developed an independent field that is known as ethics. India never developed actually quite a few fields of study that are considered to be very important in Western civilization. Is that because India is a primitive culture? Some would have you think that. The fact of the matter is that India never developed these necessities because they're actually not necessities if one understands dharma. India had dharma to fulfill the purposes that are filled by, in Western civilization, attempted to to fill in Western civilization by psychology, by ethics, by legislation, by so many things. So, atato dharma jignasa is the very first aphorism of Jainani's dharma sutras. Just like when we get beyond that, we come to Vedanta, or better known as Uttara Mimamsa. Purva Mimamsa means the study of karma or dharma. And his concern is, first let's find out what is good behavior. Let us understand what is our conditional nature. Let us act in harmony with the laws of nature. Let us basically exist as human beings so that we can even begin to think about going anywhere else. So once we do that, then we graduate. Once we assimilate sadachar, or good behavior. Good behavior in the sense of that which is taught to us by tradition and exemplified by those who are pure in heart. Parampara. Once we assimilate that, then we can actually begin to take up what is called Uttara, or later Mimamsa, which is better known as Vedanta. Sadachar is the substrate of Vedanta study. It's a prerequisite. Just like when you go to college, there are certain courses that you can't take unless you've already graduated from a prerequisite course. So in this way, every human being is expected to be civilized and law-abiding and decent and relatively enlightened, awake, progressive. The way that that is done is through the assimilation of dharma. It's a very primary lesson, but it's one which is missing in the modern day and age. People don't even have the concept. So that when we hear the term niyatam karma, it doesn't really mean anything to us. We don't recognize what it is. But all the most voluminous body of writing that exists in the Sanskrit language is called Dharmashastra, because it's meant to regulate this activity. It's meant to regulate what you should do, what you should not do. Just as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, anybody know the verse I'm thinking of? Number 23, if you know it offhand, you can sing along. It is... Yashastra vidhim utsvijya vartate kama karataha na sa siddhim avavnoti na sukham na paramgati. He says, one who gives up the injunctions, vidhi means injunctions of shastra, and acts whimsically, doesn't attain perfection. He doesn't even get happiness. What to speak of the supreme destination? To make it clear what he's getting at, he continues. Tasmat chastram pramanam te karya karya vivasthitao. Vyavastha. Vyavastha is a technical term from the Dharma Shastra, which means a judgment of what is to be done. Iti kartavyata. Something which is obligatory. So he says one should understand what is to be done and what is not to be done. On what basis? Shastra. Shastra Vidhi in particular, the injunctions. Therefore, the most voluminous body of writing is the Dharma Shastra. Because you have to take these abstract principles that we find in Vedanta and crystallized in the Bhagavad Gita, and you have to somehow know how to apply those at ground level in a specific time, place, and circumstance, and with a particular individual or set of them. That's not easy to do. And in fact, it's virtually impossible to do without a very developed sense of dharma. So this has to come first. And that's why Krishna emphasizes this, notably in chapter 16, where he's addressing the divine and mostly demoniac nature. because as if to anticipate the nature of the age that was coming as soon as he left, he knows what we need to hear. So anyway, this is when one acts in terms of one's niyatam karma, when one acts in full understanding of dharma, it actually takes a great deal of discrimination. It's not easy. One has to be trained. One has to be rather socialized in that process. And that is why Srila Prabhupada particularly in his later years, gave so many instructions to the members of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, the initiated members of that society, to develop Varnashram Dharma means to follow Varnashram Dharma. Development means you do it, because example is already better than precept. At least we have to try like that. So that's a big task. It really isn't that easy. And, you know, as I said, it's really quite complicated, because we see that in the Varnashram system, if you're a brahmachari, life is fairly simple. If you are a vanaprastha, life is becoming simple, hopefully. If you're a sannyasi, then life is also fairly simple, but when you are a grihastha, then life is very, very complicated. Very complicated. Because the grihastha is trying to juggle two things that are essentially antithetical. The spirit of enjoyment of the facilities of Krishna's material energy, legally or illegally. Hopefully legally. That's what dharma is all about. Or the tendency to run away from that through cultivating knowledge. But either way, it becomes very complicated when one conceives of oneself as an independent enjoyer. So ultimately the Varnashram system is meant to bring us to the point where we do recognize that. We do have adhikar for real spiritual knowledge. And of course we know from way back in chapter 7, text 19, that the ultimate perfection of that knowledge is what? You surrender to Krishna. You surrender to Krishna in pure, unalloyed bhakti yoga. So therefore in the Vishnu Purana, Arva Muni instructed Maharaj Sagar that Varnashrama Acharavata Purushena Parapuman. If you are a human being, ordinary human being, and you want to attain pure devotional service, the way that you do so is through performing Varnashram. It prepares you for receiving dhyan and not adulterating that dhyan. Because, as Chanakya Kautilya said, a person who hears or even perhaps memorizes shastra but does not apply them in his own life, he's just, you know, that shastra becomes poison. It becomes poison. So there are many stories about that also in Vitopadesha and other sources, but that may have to wait for another evening. But the idea here is that if one has graduated from the school of good behavior and thereby developed the adhikar to develop real spiritual knowledge, then he can mature that knowledge and come to this point of kaitava dharma, prochita, to sweep out all sorts of cheating religious activity that involves selfish endeavor. And that's where the Srimad Bhagavatam starts. Where the Bhagavad Gita leaves off, surrender to me in pure devotion, Srimad Bhagavatam begins and expands exactly how to do that. Now in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's interesting to know, we still find ample directions and examples. Kings like Maharaj Prachina Barishat, for example, who engaged in their regular niyatam karmas and even kamya karmas as well. Because dharma or karma is divided into different categories. We should have heard this in the beginning of this chapter. Did we hear it? That the difference between sannyas and tyaga that Arjuna asks about in the first few verses, the acharyas have explained. I mean, there are different opinions. But very common explanation is that sannyas means you give up both obligatory niyatam karma as well as kamya karma. Kamya karma means activities such as having a child or opening a hospital or, you know, things that you don't really have to do but that you can do if under Vedic sanction. That's called kamya, desirable, things that you want to do, desirable activities. But niyatam karma, on the other hand, means the things that you have to do. You cannot neglect those things, otherwise there is sinful activity incurred. So he says there that tyag means somebody who gives up the fruits of either one of these two activities, whereas sannyas means he gives up the activities totally. At least he gives up the kamya karma. But actually, Krishna qualifies this when he says that, in my opinion, the two are the same thing, because whether you're performing kamya karma or niyatam karma, both of them is the usual norm. He said, you should give this to me. That's what is meant by sarvadharman paritijyamamekam sharanam praja. Now, I'll just go back to text 2 since the wind opened it for me here. Kamyanam karmanam nyasam sannyasam kavyo viduhu. The poets, they call sannyas the giving up of kamya karma. Sarva karma phalatyagam prahus tyagam vichakshana. Whereas the discriminate people, they say that tyaga is giving up of the fruits only. That's Krishna's definition. That's important to consider, because Krishna later on, he goes on to say that acts of sacrifice, charity, and austerity, they purify even great souls, and they should never be given up for that reason. Etani abitu karmani sangam tyaktva phalam phalani cha kartavyani iti me mati. I'm sorry, kartavyani iti me partha nishchitam matam uttamam. My supreme opinion, O Partha, is that this is to be done. Yeah, thank you, I appreciate that. Good fan will kill me. Kartavyani iti. What does it mean in Sanskrit when you have a set of words followed by iti? Does anyone know? Usually it means that's a quote. So Krishna is quoting himself here, rhetorically. He's saying, it is to be done. This is my opinion. So it's a very definitive instruction here. Chapter 18, text number 6. Etani, all these things, api, even all these things, too. However, karmani, these karmas, they are to be done. But, sangam chatva phalanisha. Here's the difference. A person who is engaged in progressive karma yoga, or buddhi yoga, or bhakti yoga, he is giving up the sangha, the association with these activities. And sangha is a very, very subtle term which is probably too difficult to explain tonight, but it means association with the activity itself, it means association or attachment to the results of the activity, it means you have to undergo the reactions of that activity, it means you're affected by the context of that activity, by the characters involved. All these things are part of this great term called, or concept that we call sangam. So Krishna says that has to be given up on it, not the activity. So it's an internal sacrifice. On a social level, things do not necessarily change. Excuse me. Therefore, he says, way back in chapter 3, he also said, loka sangrahane vapi, even if only for the purpose of social solidarity, loka sangraham, you have to do this thing. So, now that brings us to today's verse, because when we engage in pious activity, it has a few results, many results actually. Back at the end of chapter 7, Krishna told us in text number 28, that when we are engaged in pious activity, we become freed from sin. In fact, the Acharyas are quoting the Shruti mantras about this point as well. He says, dharmena papam apanudati. That's from the Mahanarayana Upanishad 15.7. So that's one reaction. We become freed from sin, or as Krishna said in that verse, from chapter 7, we become dvandva moha, what is it? Yesham tvantagatam papam jananam punya karmanam te dvandva moha nirmukta. We become free from dvandva moha, the illusion of dualistic existence in this world that compels us to act further on the basis of this bodily ignorance of who I really am. When we are solidly fixed in piety, we become free from sin. When we are freed from sin, then we develop the adhikar for jnana. We realize who we are. And we can appreciate bhakti yoga on a whole new level. And that's exactly the point of that verse. Chapter 7, text 28. Krishna is urging Arjuna that those who are fixed in piety and freed from sin, they are the ones who sustain a mature commitment to pure devotional service. Others fall down. This is the numbers game that we hear throughout the Shastra. Manushyanam sahasreshu kashchit yatijinsit dhaye ityadi. Out of many millions who try for this spiritual perfection, very few actually gain it, Krishna says. And even of those who are relatively adept, hardly one knows me as I am. Because there's only one way to know Krishna, and that is through bhakti. And bhakti is something that is very rare, not because Krishna doesn't want to give it to us, but because we don't want to receive it from him. You see? Therefore, we have to see things in terms of bhakti. We have to have a bhakti-centric vision of all the teachings of all the shastras. And then we will see. There's no need to reject anything, and there's no need to become overly fascinated or infatuated with any of it either. We accept what is useful for the advancement of spiritual life and reject everything else. There's a very nice purport here in this very chapter when Prabhupada addresses the difference between Niyatam Karma and Kamya Karma. He says, although all sacrifices are purifying, this is his purport to text 6, one should not expect any result by such performances. In other words, all sacrifices which are meant for material advancement in life should be given up. That he's talking about Kamya Karma, according to the Acharyas. On the other hand, sacrifices that purify one's existence and elevate one to the spiritual plane should not be stopped. That's talking about Niyatam Karma, according to our Acharyas, commenting on Bhagavad Gita. In other words, dharma. Niyatam Karma means dharma, in a nutshell. So, that's one thing. It directly qualifies us for really embracing the process of bhakti yoga wholeheartedly instead of half-heartedly. That's why it's important. I would think that that's why Srila Prabhupada gave 80% of his instructions on Varnashram in the last 3 years, that he saw that we needed those instructions. He saw the great need for it. Now, just there are some fringe benefits here as well. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, part 1, chapter 5, it says, Karmana Pitraloka, one will attain to the higher planets by performing good karma. So you're not bereft of the results of good karma just by doing bhakti yoga, because bhakti yoga entails doing good karma. It is punya shravana kirtana. Therefore, anishtam ishtam mishvam cha, if you do not, this is the point of the last verse, according to Baladev Vidyapushan, that if you do not accept the process of renunciation by accepting the activities and rejecting the sangha attached to them, in other words, if your renunciation is tamasic, that's the purport of this text here. Text number 7. Niyatasya tu sannyasa. If somebody gives up niyatam karma, karma na nopapadyate, mohatasya pratyagas, out of ignorance of scriptural injunctions, then that renunciation is called ignorance. It's said to be in the mode of ignorance. Prescribed duty should never be renounced, period. That's what it says here in the translation. If one gives up his prescribed duties because of illusion or ignorance, moha means both, such renunciation is said to be in the mode of ignorance. Nice purport there as well, but I'm just going to try to be brief here so that we can continue with today's verse. So, another benefit of performing pious activity is that one is elevated, and that's called ishtam. according to Vishnacha, we've already talked about. One is elevated to higher planets. Of course, for devotees, this is not so relevant because we want to go higher than the higher planets. We want to go back to Godhead. But the result of not developing the proper spirit of renunciation, which Baladeva Dalpushan defines as renouncing activities instead of performing those activities with a spirit of renunciation. In other words, by renouncing the activity altogether, whether out of ignorance or whatever force is impelling one, if one indiscriminately renounces activities that are enjoined in Shastra, then he says, you do not get the result of that renunciation. You get anishtam. You get something which is not desired. That's a very, very important point to consider here. So ishtam means you go to Svarga Loka if you want, or you go back to Godhead if you prefer. Anishtam means if you're not careful, if you do not discriminate about what is to be done and what is not to be done on the basis of Shastra, you may very well end up in hell. Or at least you'll get something that you don't want. And most of us are actually in between. We take birth again and again in this human realm, in the material world, bhuloka, that we're living in, because we're mishra. Karma mishra bhakti or jnana mishra bhakti, happiness and distress also mishra, this is our ordinary experience. This verse describes the result of not accepting the proper mode of renunciation. That's the purport here. Bhavati atyagina pretya. Those who are not tyagis, and you remember the distinction between sannyasis and tyagis. It's not just a question of adopting a new order of life or putting on saffron cloth. It's a question of giving up the association with the fruits of your endeavors. That's what defines a tyagi. So, a person who's not such a tyagi, whether out of ignorance or out of deliberate passion, pretya, when he leaves this world, natu sannyasi nam kuchita, he doesn't get the result of his renunciation. But for the sannyasis, it's never like that, because sannyasi means he's able to give it up. So therefore, Prabhupada writes, a person in Krishna consciousness, acting in knowledge of his relationship. Knowledge is one thing, relationship is another thing. With Krishna, that person is always liberated. Relationship. What does relationship mean? We are all related to everyone else. Chiefly we're related to Krishna. But it is not negligible, the fact that we're related to everything and everyone else. So the science that governs relationships, that orders relationships, in any world you live in, either this material world or the spiritual world, that is called karma. The ordering or the coursing of relationships. There's a very nice word back in Vedic Sanskrit. It means the coursing of this universal order. And that word is rita. It's not very often used, but mostly in the sources we find that it's replaced by the word karma. But this is the idea here. So, we have to act in knowledge, and that knowledge has to be tempered by purity of heart, because you can memorize the Shastra, but if you're not acting on them, it's still poisonous. So the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, should inspire and direct our knowledge appropriately. When that happens, then we are awakened not only to our relationship with Krishna, but by dint of that awakening, knowledge of our relationship with all things and all beings. And if we awaken in that way, then we are always liberated. It's two sentence purport, let's see how deep it is. Therefore, he does not have to enjoy or suffer the results of his acts after death. A Krishna conscious person means a person who has done this. He does not have to suffer like the ordinary people or the atyagis mentioned here. Those who are not so renounced. So I'm going to stop here. If anybody has any questions or comments, please feel free. Okay. No comments? Or yeah?
So usually we say Shreyan Swadharma.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has some abilities in different fields of knowledge. So usually the thing is that devotee wants to serve in that, but he's being told to serve in another service. So how can he understand?
Shreyam Sadharma Vigunaha Paradharma Sanushtita is an instruction that Krishna mentions twice in the Bhagavad Gita. He mentions it in this chapter, he mentioned it before as well. It's an important principle. So I think you're asking that if a person is engaged in some capacity other than his own dharma,
if he's perfect in one dharma, like
yeah.
Example,
yeah.
He's good at cooking.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things to there's actually several things to consider here. It's a very multifaceted question. There are many possibilities that would explain that situation. One possibility is that the person doesn't understand his own Swadharma. Perhaps a more likely possibility is that the person engaging him doesn't understand that person's Swadharma, which is ignorance. And I believe that that's the kind of thing that Srila Prabhupada really kind of hoped that we would grow out of eventually. A third possibility is that a person has actually become so transcendentally awakened and realized that he is no longer limited to performing a particular dharma impelled by his own psychophysical conditioning. That's the very best thing. But it's also very rare. And so we have to be very careful about assuming erroneously that everyone in the entire society is actually that much enlightened, because it's usually not so. So, the very highest thing is, one way to interpret sarva dharman parityajamame kam sharanam praja is that a person is willing to do anything for Krishna. And that's glorious if you actually have that adhikar. There's another nice verse which our acharyas quote from the 11th canto as well. Sve sve adhikare ya nishtha sa guna parikirtataha. The person who is fixed in his own adhikar. Adhikar is a nice word in Sanskrit that has no English equivalent. The closest that I've been able to find is the word prerogative. Because prerogative means at once the ability to do something and also the authorization to do that thing. And that's what adhikar means. So the person who is fixed in his own adhikar means the person who understands what he's capable of and is working in that capacity, working to his full capacity, which means he doesn't attempt to do anything beyond his capacity, and he also does not settle with anything less than his capacity. That's called qualification. And to do anything else, the second half of the verse says, that's called dosha. Dosha means a flaw. If you try to do something that you're not fit to work to do, that's a flaw. If you are not, if you're complacently satisfied doing less than you're actually qualified to do, that's also a flaw. If you're wrongly engaged because your authority doesn't understand your conditional nature, then that's also a flaw. If you think that you're more advanced than you are, and you try to engage on a completely transcendental platform when you're actually not fit to do so, that's also a flaw. So one has to understand all these things in context. Always in the Shastra, the instructions have to be taken in their context. That mimamsa, the word for that is called mimamsa. I spoke of before, Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa, but Mimamsa actually means discrimination. One has to exercise it. It's the key word of Madhyama Adhikar in Bhakti Yoga, discrimination.
What it is, usually the higher authorities, they have their mind. So, like, although there is an elderly person, he can do the job best, but they put their limit. So, how we should understand?
Swajana mentality, as Prabhupada said. Yeah, everybody has his own men. Well, you know, that's. You have to understand the nature of politics and the nature of government is that a person in a position of political authority or governmental authority is always going to act on that level. It's just, it's part of the dharma, and it really is hard to avoid that. But at the same time, as much as possible, we're instructed to not do that. In other words, we're instructed to try to approach the brahminical ideal, especially in a brahminical society like the International Society of Christian Consciousness.
Because in that case, you're using the best men, don't you?
Yeah, in that case, it's really a question of personal ambition, I think, versus the interests of the society as a whole. Prabhupada used to say that one should think of we think of the world first, think of your zone or region second, and think of your temple last. If you're a manager. So that kind of selfless spirit and, you know, dedication to the interests of the other person, really, it's very hard for the kshatriya. We have to empathize with them for that reason. It's really not easy to do that because there are needs that need to be fulfilled, and the person who is acting in the kshatriya capacity may be underqualified for trying to do that dharma as well. It's just not easy. And most of us, kalau shudra sambhava, I mean, we're all considered to be shudras. So what does that say about the difficulty of trying to do anything higher than that? It's not going to be easy. So we have to have a lot of, I think, empathy and also sympathy. Is that okay? Patience. But we should never, ever neglect the fact that Srila Prabhupada really did push on this point a lot, that, you know, things have to crystallize. They have to come into this natural form of society eventually. And, you know, our volition has a large part to play in that. It's not going to happen automatically. It requires our hard work, and it requires the investment of our energy.
What do you say that Prabhupada used his disciples in their skills? What are the skills they had?
Yeah, and even Srila Prabhupada actually used to take advice from his disciples if they were expert in a particular field because of this principle. If you're not expert in something, then find the person who isn't. Inquire submissively from that person. That's the principle. It's an absolute one in that sense. So, is that okay? Anything else?